The following content contains adult subject matter, including sensitive material, and is intended for adult consumption only. It may not be suitable for all audiences. Therefore, discretion is advised.
Hello, Colbertos. Welcome back to Breaking Down, you guys. It's with a heavy heart that I share that today will be our last episode of Breaking Down for the time being. I'm going to take a pause from the show. I'm sure I'll be back. I love you guys so much. I'm so appreciative of everyone who's listened to the show and stayed with it in all of its iterations from, you know, Dear Media, The Ali Colbert Show, and here at Spotify. And I will be back, but we're going to be taking a little bit of a pause. And I'm so grateful for all of you who tuned in and enjoyed the show and shared the show and hated the show and commented the show. And today on Breaking Down, I have on two amazing art critics. Amazing isn't even the right word, but a very famed New York old media couple, art critics Roberta Smith of the New York Times and Jerry Saltz from New York Magazine. They're both so knowledgeable. And, you know, this is kind of a different conversation than I usually have on the show, but hearing them talk about art is both insightful and inspirational. And I know there's plenty you can take from it. So I hope you enjoy it and learn something. They're just amazing. And also, before I forget, if you're in Los Angeles, May 12th, come to my show at the Netflix Festival. I'd love to see you. The Elysian Theater. You can get tickets on my website, AliColbert.com, on my Instagram, Ali Colbert. Come on down. Say hi. I'll give you maybe a hug or a handshake, depending on how clean you look. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Love you.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hey, congratulations on retiring.
Thank you. That's what everyone is saying. I wasn't expecting that particular word, but yeah.
How did you arrive at the decision?
We were away for COVID for I don't know how many months or years, but I said to people that that was like practice retirement and I didn't like it. But as time went on, you know, I just wanted to try something else. I wanted to do something with my time. I mean, I've been publishing reviews since around 1972. And it just was like, and I always thought I would go out of the Times feet first, but that stopped appealing. And I got more and more curious about what would happen if I didn't have this structure of deadlines and seeing things. And I just wanted to be without it. Plus, I'm not even that much without it because I'm going to write for them a little bit, and I can, if I have other things that I feel, you know, I must write about, they'll definitely consider it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an easy retirement, but it's just so amazing not to have deadlines,
So far it feels good.
So far it feels good. You know, I usually have something in my head that I'm writing and that I'm thinking about. And so I'm feeling like I slowed down a little. You know, I said to Jerry, you know, I might be dumber after we do this.
No, but not at all. I would imagine you still would have the instinct to see something and want to write it down, even though you don't have a deadline.
Absolutely. And I still want to see things. I probably will be able to go to galleries more without deadlines. But the Times has this weird little gallery section on Fridays of three short reviews, and they've just switched to having one critic write them every week. And I'm still in that rotation. So every 7 weeks, I'll have those. And I also have Instagram. Instagram's great for short reviews and, you know, giving a few photographs of the show. And I usually know when that's the case. You know, I usually walk in and say, I could review this. And, you know, since I don't have the Times, I can just do a couple hundred words on Instagram.
Yeah. Why do you think you haven't taken to Instagram in the same way that Jerry has, though?
Because we're just completely different personalities, and he understands the potential for certain things. And I also think his, getting back to the personality point, Jerry wants to connect in a very personal way with people. And, you know, before there was Instagram and he was just teaching at RISD, we would go to galleries on Saturday and I'd turn around and Jerry would be surrounded by like 10 or 15 people, some of whom were his students, you know, going around. And this wasn't planned. And then other people would join in. And I see it as what he's always done. He's always taken a lot of photographs. It was sort of made for him.
You know, like your marriage has become, I think, a point that people kind of fall in love with online in addition to your work. Do you know that? That people see that and are so kind of endeared to your relationship?
I've seen some of it. I mean, mostly it's through him. You know, because he's such an endearing guy. So he's a great, I consider him a fabulous front man for a person with my personality, which doesn't connect the way he connects to people. You know, he's this empath. So he reads people when he meets them in the street and the tone of the Instagrams. But somebody's making a documentary. So we'll see how that goes.
About your relationship.
Yeah, but I've sort of resisted it the whole way, and then Jerry's been doing it, so.
Oh, wow.
We'll see what happens.
What do you think it is that, like, creates such a long-lasting, sustaining marriage? I mean, the way he sounds completely in love with you. Do you like him?
Oh, I like him. I like him very, very much. No, the feeling is mutual, but I think that what keeps people, I mean, our personalities fit together very well. You know, we both like to joke a lot. But I think that having art together is just, it just amplifies and elevates the whole thing and sort of takes it outside of us in a certain way. Like we can just deal with what kinds of reactions we're having to the same thing, you know, and just that becomes very interesting and weirdly impersonal in certain ways, like, oh, you disagree with me, or oh, we, you know,
right.
So it just keeps it very lively. It's just great. I don't know what I would have done. I wouldn't, if I'd been with someone who wasn't interested in art, they'd get about 90% of my personality. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I were with somebody outside the art world and outside the world of writing, even if they had these great things, we had these great things in common, that person wouldn't really know me. And that person would certainly, you know, Jerry and I can tolerate what the other's going through because we know exactly what it means. We know what it means to struggle to meet a deadline and then be very anxious for an editor's reaction, then to work with the editor to make changes. You know, you just know and you understand the different tensions and degrees of changing degrees of comfort. Of that, like when you first file something, you're sort of in a daze, like you're so amazed with yourself, and then you realize you have to wait and see, well, what do they think? Do they like it? Do they like me? It's very infantilizing in a way, and then they respond, and then you start working on this thing together, and it becomes a kind of collaboration where, you know, they make good suggestions, and then I see other things. And editing is, I always think that editing, at least for journalists, and I'm a kind of journalist critic, is where you learn to write, you know, because somebody else imparts their knowledge of language, grammar, the definition of words or of pace or tone. You know, you get this and you absorb it from different people, and it just contributes to your being more specific about your own. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I've always said I didn't know if I would continue writing if I left the Times. That I was so nurtured by that structure and at home in a certain way.
That's so fascinating to me as a writer, the idea that editing teaches you how to write. And I feel so true to me. Do you feel that every year you were working there, you would become better then? That that's how that is as a writer?
I didn't feel it, but just before I was going, I have been feeling over the past year that I wanted to spend more time on writing. So that's a good sign. But also, I didn't have that time in terms of deadlines. So I don't know what it's really like to kind of seep in my own writing.
Right. Marinate, you know, and stew.
Marinate. Yeah. That's what I meant. Yeah. So that's an interesting, like, do you make it worse as you go on? Is it less fun? I just think it would be, you know, because I can rewrite forever. That was one of the things that used to get me in trouble with the copy desk, that I'd sit down with a copy editor and start saying, oh yeah, here's a better way to say that, you know, but the idea of that writing is never perfect and infinitely perfectible. And that every time I would see a text before it was set, I would try to make little changes, and it got me into trouble. But it's just that you see more with each pass.
Yeah. You know, I watched you and Jerry doing an interview in Vienna on YouTube, and you said that there is a continual remorse that you feel being in print, that you didn't write about this, or you didn't get this opinion as clearly as you wanted. And you talked about having this itchiness that you keep hoping you find a job that fits your neuroses. And I thought that was so well said. I feel that way in stand up, and you know, that I'm getting closer and closer to something, and you always reflect on something, and it's not quite there, but you kind of maybe for a moment it felt clear and precise, and then you kind of look at it and you can see that there's these wonky parts.
That's a constant feeling for me. And I think that you have to have, maybe there's a kind of masochism in that, but basically that's how people who do things week in and week out, that's a kind of neuroses that you have, that you're constantly writing. Everything you write is, you know, is a certain kind of anxiety attack. And then you feel good, and then you start it again. But you know, I have so many, I have more artists whose shows I remember that I didn't write about that I wanted to, or I should have, you know, could have, should have. But writing is the most interesting thing, you know, because you're just, it's so nothing. You're just constructing something out of language. And it's given a certain physicality, whether on a screen or on the printed page. And it can be something just, well, as we all know, it can just be phenomenal. But you get to a point, if you're doing it, you're kind of both knocked out and cowed by that. You know, like you think, well, I'm not writing anything that's going to last for the ages, you know. But then you just view, I mean, when I was first writing this, I used to say to people, it has such a short shelf life. I write it fast, you read it fast, you get something out of it, and then it's gone.
Yeah.
That's no longer the case. This stuff, I don't know where it lasts or how long, but it's much more, has a much longer life. You know, I like that rhythm. So you get into that rhythm, and that becomes part of how you operate. That you, whatever your feelings about one piece, you can't dwell on it too long because you're going toward the next, and then the next, and the next. And that's a very, you could say that's inhibiting in terms of real development. Or that it's a, like an anesthesia in terms of being conscious of your work, you know, like you block out what maybe wasn't so good. And it's amazing. It's like being in training in a certain way, you know, that you always have the structure to rely on. And then, like I said, I don't know what I'm going to do, you know? I think I will write, but I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, how could you not really at this point? I mean, I have such a hard time imagining a writer not writing. I mean, because you weren't only writing because it was your job, right?
Oh, no. I was writing because I developed a kind of propensity for discussing my reactions and for kind of deconstructing whatever work of art was causing those. And I don't think I would abruptly stop writing, but I think it's possible to imagine just doing letters. I mean, that's how I became a writer. Was I would write these endless letters home, and it sort of got me into a kind of rhythm of it. But I don't know, because the other thing that happens if you've been at the paper, at the Times as long as I have, you have a certain kind of definition of your audience, and you're very used to writing in a certain framework. And the most important thing for me is you don't know your audience, you don't know the size of it, but it has a certain character to you, for you, and you're writing to it. So like if I wrote for Vogue or something, I don't have any sense of that audience, do you know? And I'm in a completely different kind of publication, so things like that would really, I remember writing a little piece for Vogue and it practically killed me, because I just couldn't. You know, I'd say to Sherry, it's on the wrong kind of paper. It's going to be on glossy paper, you know?
Right. I understand that sentiment. How do you reflect on, I mean, the Times is such an institution. By the way, my girlfriend is a tips reporter there.
Oh, really?
Yes. And she's obsessed with the Times. I mean, she like wears a Times sweatshirt around the house and buys the print copy. I mean, she's just so ridiculously infatuated with it. And I mean, I think it's the greatest newspaper of all time, but how do you reflect on your time at such an iconic institution? Are you, I mean, how does that feel?
Well, now that I've started to like leave the dock, I don't know. I mean, I was very much, you know, nose to the grindstone. And the thing about the critics in the culture department at the Times is that I had a very specific ability. I wasn't like, you know, like Michael Kimmelman and other people had stories to tell and different kinds of narratives. I didn't really have that. And so I was very focused. But I would read about the Times and I would read about, I read obits. That's my first subject. I read them every day. So you would learn about the Times from that. And, you know, it just has changed. I mean, I've been there, I've been under probably 12 or 13 culture chiefs, do you know? Mm-hmm. And I was there when they had the copy desks, and now I've written for quite a while when they took them away, which was a tremendous shock that, you know, we recovered from, as they said we would. But yeah, the Times has an amazing history. I tend not to know what's going on. I mean, if your girlfriend knows what's going on in the present moment, she's ahead of me. You know, the thing is that I work at home, and there was a kind of water cooler structure. And I just go in and I talk to people out here like, whoa, I didn't know that was going on. So I'm in and out of it, but I'm really writing for culture as I did. I had a very cloistered existence. I didn't know, you know, I knew a lot of bylines and I didn't know a lot of people. I don't think a lot of people knew me. I don't know what they knew me, but I mean, I don't know how they knew me going by my byline. So I was always sort of seemed like an island, you know, like that Robert Smithson island that floated up the Hudson, like attached to the Times, but not, because this is the only place where, if you were a critic, you stayed in one place. You stayed in culture. Yeah. And reporters come and go, and, you know, editors would come and go. But we were always in this one place. So that may or may not be healthy, but it, you know, there's no, I don't think there's anything else like that. There's no other position, you know, unless somebody is like a fabulous sports writer, which, you know, sports writing is a form of criticism.
You know, I'm like kind of most intimidated by the sort of art that you review. Like, you know, even my entryway into learning about you and Jerry, I feel like I have like an innate like taste when it comes to like move film and TV and music. But there's something so daunting about fine arts that I wonder why, especially people of my generation, kind of feel so intimidated to even have like an entry point to. When I ask my peers or my younger siblings about that art, like that art that you see at the Met or the MoMA, it feels so out of reach for people of my generation sometimes. I know I'm making a generalization, but what would you say is a great or a good entryway into having a kind of more sophisticated relationship with art?
Well, I would say the number one thing is learning to trust your own reactions. And as much as they might embarrass you or mystify you, go into them and try to figure out why, you know, it's like you kind of have to, quote, interrogate your reactions. They're subjective, but you can kind of pull back and think about it. And read criticism or read whatever to get how other people are feeling, to find out if it matches your reaction. But the first thing is you being in front of a work of art physically, not seeing it on the screen. And everything else in our culture has, I mean, particularly music, you know, we know what we think about music. I mean, I think people are like, you know, seething opinions, teeming with opinions that they sort of just have, and they don't mistrust them. And, you know, like one example I used to always use is, you know, that Arrested Development, if you know what that is, Arrested Development is literally progress beyond friends. You know that a form has been worked with and made more intense and psychological and entertaining, or whatever you want to say about it, completely nuts. Or you know when pop music sounds new. I mean, you're not listening to the same music all the time, or even like, you know, redos, covers of it.
Yeah.
So everybody has a lot of critical knowledge about their experience. I mean, getting dressed. They're all, you know, I just think it's interesting to think about, you know, 90% of your opinions, 90% of your experience, let's say, is based on decisions that are to some extent aesthetic. You know, music is just, we experience it in a really physiological way. I mean, it's really hard to listen to music that you hate. Your body will tell you if it hates it. Maybe, and the same, I think, is true with theater. But definitely music. And we're around music all the time. So if you think about being around art, we could talk about that. I mean, there's a lot of popular culture that you're always seeing wherever you go in the city. The thing about art is you have to look. You can read for a certain amount. You can take classes. But if you're not looking and thinking and making mistakes, even within your own mind, you're not developing. And it's easy to develop once you start doing that. But it takes a kind of, well, I may be stupid now, but I can get through this, you know, and understanding that you can learn very quickly. And so if you can get yourself to look at art as much as you listen, you know, you do other forms that you're interested in. And, you know, it could be baseball, it could be music, because they're critical faculty or facility, whichever you want to call it, is operating while you're watching sports, or it's operating, obviously, at music. A really great work of art is like the shortest line between two dots, you know, two points. Like if you have an artwork that's sort of going out like this and then coming around, it's like, it seems too slow and it slows you down and it seems indulgent.
Does that mean that if you look at a piece of art, you can tell this is very reductive language, but that you could tell very quickly if it's good or not?
Well, you can certainly operate with that illusion. And I've operated with that illusion for a long time, and it's been reasonably reliable, but there are works of art that take really a long time. You know, sometimes it's like a second visit, sometimes it's a few years, and that you change your mind about. But I just think you start with what you get. One definition of a critic is a critic is someone who is willing to be betrayed by their own taste. Like you can go look at as many artworks as you want with a very strict idea of what you like. And maybe you'll eliminate some things that'll be outside the realm of possibility within that. And then all of a sudden, you're going to come smack up against something that you've told yourself for years you hate. And you're going to slowly change your position on that, you know? But people are very intimidated about trusting their own reactions. And you have nothing else to go on. Like somebody can't tell you, this is good, and you're going to say, oh, yeah, that's good, and not really feel it. Eventually, you'll just not be interested in that thing. So you have to, it has to come from you. It's great if you have teachers or friends or you, if you have lots of stimulation from the outside, but it's up to you to think like, oh yeah, I can see that that's better. And nobody else in the room thinks that, but it's okay for me to think that.
Yeah. After, you know, so many years of experiencing, reviewing, observing, examining art, do you feel that there are certain larger lessons you're taking away about just humanity, about man, about how we feel and express? I mean, is there broad stroke moral of the story moments?
Well, the first thing, I don't know about that. That's a big question for me. I'm very much, I'm interested in local perceptions, you could say, but every culture has had it. It's been a necessity, you know, used for good reasons or bad. It's something that every culture has left behind, and it's a major form of communication to us from that culture. And I think it's just, I think it's a basic human need. Do you know, I get trouble from my husband for this, but I think it's a sustaining thing. It's a form of sustenance. It's like food. It's like sex. It's like, it's always going to be there, and people are always going to do an, most cultures and most, you know, groups are going to do enough to leave something behind and to make an impression on our understanding of what happened. And we can, no one person can ever know what all that is. Do you know, that's the great thing about art. You can't ever stop learning. So,
You know, you saying that that art is this, gets to be this kind of third thing that you and Jerry share and you have opinions about. It's very similar to how I feel about a sense of humor, not only in that like humor is like, you know, as a comedian, it's interesting and it's fun, but it gives you an opportunity with people, you know, it allows someone, you know, to kind of become new again all the time. Because to me, at least, the things I find the most funny are generally things that surprise me, but I agree with.
Yeah. Well, there might be things that surprise you that make you change your mind, but we won't go there.
How would it make me change my mind?
But no, that's totally fine. And I also think that really, if you don't have a sense of humor, your intelligence isn't as high as it might be. And if you don't have a sense of doubt, if you're not willing to question yourself, that's also a sign of lower intelligence. Because, and this, what we're enduring right now is a lot of people who are sure about, beyond question, about certain aspects of religion, certain aspects of, say, presidential candidates right now. It's just that certainness means that there's not further thought going on outside of what they're certain about. And I think that the whole, I think I'll just say this one more kind of really gross generalization. I mean, I just think that there's so many unhappy people in America, and they're easily manipulated, and they have no idea what life can be. They have that nothing profound has really distracted them from certain issues, like that have nothing to do with them, you know, abortion or gay marriage or whatever. I mean, that's what they fasten on. They get to that through religion, and you just, you just want to say, have you ever been outside the state? You know, have you ever been outside the country? It's just so sad. You die with, they have such a narrow, I mean, I'm sure there are exceptions, and I'm sure there are people that spend their lives living in these places because they have a certain love for nature or for history or whatever. But you just feel these people are so unexposed to human interaction and to their own pleasure and their own self-knowledge. Mm. And that's what happens when you're a kid. Something, art opens you up. Something opens you up that you didn't know was in there. And you find it and you know what you want to do with your life. And that's why you have art, various art forms taught in schools. Because otherwise, it's. I mean, you can find it your own. You can come to New York having no idea what you do, and you probably would find it. You know, there are a lot of people who come to New York to be artists and find they're not artists, so they find other ways to be involved.
And thank God.
Yeah. I mean, the art world is practically run by these people.
You said Jerry would challenge you on your theory of art as sustenance. Maybe it's a good place to bring Jerry in and have him debate.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
This episode is brought to you by Rakuten. If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Samsung, Expedia, and Sephora. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Jerry, you're so in love with your wife.
Yes, aren't you?
I'm obsessed with her, and I'm obsessed with how you're obsessed with her. You're so in love with her. It's so beautiful.
Well, thank you. But this is why I've always said, and I wrote on the day I won the Pulitzer Prize, that the prize should have gone to Roberta 100%. I'm fine. I love my work. But what you just heard, nobody else says. I'm just going to say a bunch of fun nonsense, but you just were at a core.
I do traffic in a lot of fun nonsense, but I do agree that she is much more insightful and brilliant than you and me.
Yeah, totally.
You know, but I'm endeared to also your sense of humor. You know, you've made the work you do accessible to a stand-up comedian like me, who otherwise, honestly, wouldn't really be having a conversation with two art critics that are famed kind of a New York media couple, you know?
Because your process and our process do not differ. They come from flying by the seat of our pants, not knowing what we're doing, needing attention, being unafraid just enough to be embarrassed by everything we do, and putting it out there as often as possible. That's what you are doing, Allie, and that's what makes what you do work. Although what you're doing works better for you because it looks like you're sitting in an amazing hotel and I'm here in my crapola apartment.
I am in a 500 square foot studio. The windows are very lovely, but my girlfriend and I are both here. My girlfriend, who is a journalist for the New York Times. So we're kind of a modern Jerry and Roberta couple. We're just like a younger, dykier version.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
So we're kind of coming to fill your shoes.
Yes.
But I, you know, you talk about finding writing at 40. 40, right?
Yeah.
I'm blown away by that. Can we talk about that? It gives me a lot of hope.
How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I am 30.
So when I was 30 years old, I was an angry young man. I was a long-distance truck driver, the only Jewish one that I knew of, that I never drove 18-wheelers. Jews are not allowed to drive them. I was would drive to Florida or to Texas, occasionally to California once a month. And I was hanging out in the art world on the 10 days I was home, but I was filled with envy and fear and, you know, self aggrandizement and self-fucking delusion. How come nobody's paying attention to me, the genius? How come they have the money? Why do I have to work? Why is this one have a better neck? Why is that one better looking? And I was eating myself alive. And then to skip 10 years, I had started as an artist, by the way, and I allowed the demons to speak to me. And I listened, like you both should never do, you and your girlfriend. Listen, but then say, fuck you, and go back to being a bad comedian or a bad whatever you are. But don't do what I did and quit. It's very painful. At 40, while in the trucks, I decided anything on this earth would be better than what I'm doing. So having never written a word in my life, no degrees, never went to school, total loser from the suburbs, a white man with a dream, decided to show up at some party. And when somebody said, yo, what do? I went, I'm an art critic. And they went, cool. And that's how I became an art critic. Unfortunately, I had to start writing. So I want everybody listening to this podcast, get to work, you big fucking babies. It is hard. No one ever said it's going to be easy. No one gets out of here alive. No one gets out without fear and pain. And it will be amazing because your worst life, your worst hours will at least be spent trying to do something extraordinary that is likened only unto your idiot voice. Just tell your own idiot story, and you, I promise, will be interesting.
You know, I've heard you talk about how you have to finish the damn thing. I struggle with this because I do think perfection gets in the way of progress all the time, everyone. How do you know when to put it down or when to say this is enough?
Listen, all of us, a comedian when she's going out on the stage wants to polish the joke. The comedian on the stage is changing up the joke mid-telling. That is what art is. Art is not a dead thing. Art is something that's a noun, a verb. It's alive. It's changing. Art is something that does something. You, Ali, you have got to just say, this joke is, it's okay. I will workshop it for the next 50 years, and it'll eventually land. That's all an art critic is doing. I write 4,000 words to get, and I write them over and over and over and over to get a 900-word review that I read, and I think, I'm a fucking genius. But then somebody will say one word to me about, like, well, I like how you described the vortex of that thing, and I'll go, vortex? I should have said vortex. And that's what happens. You'll try to make it better. And I want you to just finish it. What are you worrying about?
That it could be better and that it's an embarrassing reflection of me.
Well, of course it's an embarrassing reflection of you. The best is an embarrassing reflection of you. And the other thing I've said, and I'm going to really not kid about this. After you get a bad review, have you ever gotten a bad review?
My review is live, bombing. Yeah, okay. But in stand-up, your review is in the moment, and if you hear nothing, it's a bad review,
That's depressing, and you've had that, but then you save yourself in the moment or the next time. Now, yeah. No one writes negative criticism. Everyone likes everything. I didn't get into the art world because I wanted art, because I thought it was interesting and everything was good. But that's me. And now the world has changed.
No one gets bad reviews.
No one gets bad reviews because there's no negative criticism. Roberta was the best alive. I do think she's the best working art critic alive that writes pure art criticism. I'm willing to write negative stuff, and people tear me new assholes every day online. There's 4,000 comments telling me what a dumb ass I am. And to everyone, I always think, you could be right, you know? And to everyone, I always think, you can't say anything to me worse about myself than I have said 100 times before. I think everybody, like Roberta says, everybody has their own opinion. This is mine. Anyway, I want people to just, you know, suck it up and finish the damn thing. Get to work. Hang out with others of your ilk, your ugly, stinky, shamanic kind that is living on the edge of the aesthetic village and making this horrendous shit that no one needs, but yet you go on to stage, Allie, and you are trying to dance as hard or as soft or as fast as you can, and enough people in the room need it that you get to keep your phony baloney job and not have to work in the real world, because you are useless in the real world. I am useless in the real world. If I had to go out and get a real job, I would be dead in 6 months. I would not be able to do it. I'm an excellent parallel parker, but that is about all I'm capable of doing.
I am so lucky that I can make 10 cents doing what I do. It's not lost on me for even a moment.
How much do you make?
Barely anything. As a stand-up comedian, if you perform a 15-minute set at a comedy club in New York during the week, that could be $30. On the weekend, it could be $80.
Jesus God. I'm going to ask a question that you do not have to answer. Are you able to support yourself?
Yes, but not purely doing stand-up ever. I have to write scripts and sell scripts. I have to post dumb things on my Instagram. I get to, I should say. And I'm very pleased to do it because then I can do my stupid art.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fact that I can do any of this and make a dollar is ridiculous to me. And I'm thrilled about it.
You know, in your world, it's like the poetry world, that there's so little money at stake. And the war at every level is so intense that, I don't know, I admire you for being a survivor, and I think pretty fucking good at what you do, but what do I know? I'm not your audience.
Thank you. I'll take your opinion. No, yeah, and anyone who wants can be my audience. But, you know, I heard you say, and I loved this. So you'll probably like that, my opinion, because it was loving you. But you said you don't listen to white male stand-up comedians because they have no inner lives.
100%. They're boring. Yes, they're going to talk about women and women's boobs. Everybody likes boobs. But they're not saying anything. They're telling us what we already know. It's like Norman Rockwell. He tells you exactly what to feel, how to feel it, when to notice it. I'm only interested in the inner life of women. And I just remembered the other thing I was going to say to people. The people that are afraid, I have good and bad news for you. When you get your worst reviews, other than some of your friends thinking, yes, they got dissed, that's good. We all love when our friends get bombed. That's great. That's what love is. But what I would say is I want to reassure anyone listening to this, no one is ever, ever fucking thinking of you ever, ever. So you're free to do whatever you want. And about women comics, I love them. The worst woman comment is almost better than the best male comic right now. I'm very old and untrained, so I still like Dave LaChapelle and a couple of others, but you can't blame me for that. I'm just an idiot with blinders on, but I love what you're all doing. I think the comedy is a very high art, but it's very here and very gone. And I don't know how you can preserve it and make it live. I don't know, because everything is now about big numbers, big audiences, top 10 lists, most money, high, you know. I don't know. I would play the woman card and the dyke card as hard as I could.
I'm playing it as hard as I can. You know, it's an interesting thing you say about how it's here and then gone. You know, there's this debate in the stand-up community about what it means if you post a clip of yourself telling jokes online.
Tough.
Especially if you're talking to the crowd, because people say it's offensive to the art form that you whittle it down to a clip and you put it online out of context. At the same time, it gets you more audience members, you move tickets, you probably make more money as an artist, you get to do more shows as an artist. So is it good for the artist, bad for the art form?
I know what I think, but I'd love to hear your opinion.
I think whatever it takes to make a career as an artist so that you get to say whatever it is you want to say to more people works. To me, I don't think it's degrading to art. That feels a bit pretentious to me. I think the whole thing is meant to be fun and silly, and you're meant to have a good time. So if someone in middle America who has never seen a lesbian before hears me talking about it and then gets to come to my show, I don't really give a fuck that it was circulated on Instagram.
Beautiful. I happen to love the clips of Jessie Kearson. I can't remember her name.
Oh, is she not the best? Jessie Kearson. I think she's phenomenal. Have you seen her live?
I've never seen her live, but as a non-audience member, I adore her and all the people that do audience work online. I think that, do you do a lot of audience work?
Yes, I find it to be so fun, and I think the audience loves it more than anything. They feel like anything can happen.
That's it. That's very smart, because that's changing comedy from the purely invulnerable position of a white male on stage speaking from the top down to an interaction, at least a place where every psychotic in the audience is going to try to speak up. And your job is to try to make sure the men don't start telling their opinions and that you just stay in a nice repartee with people. I don't know. I love what you're saying. I love what you're all doing. I almost am sad that I'm going to miss in 50 years how this thing changes the entire culture. But right now you're changing it. So God love you, God, and bless you for it.
Oh, wow. Thank you. I say, hey, right. You know, comedians, though, they say generally, if you're doing crowd work, it's really because a symptom of the fact that you're not writing. You're not really working.
Oh, fuck that. I say to everybody, you've heard me say this before, never don't stay in your own lane. Do everything you want. Do anything you want. Everybody listening to this, and you and I, we agree with that. If you have a feeling, follow it. It's only going to lead you someplace. What is the problem? I've seen whole acts that are all crowd work, and I love them. There's a woman from England that asks sex questions, and she's fantastic. You love it. I love it. Fuck everybody that doesn't, and they'll say that to us. It's not writing. Writing is the worst thing on earth. Never wish that people should write. Nothing is harder. Oh,
yeah, I couldn't agree more.
I wish that we could both. I wish this for all writers, that we could train a ChatGPT box with all of our work and throw in a few of our favorite influences to write our idiot work. I would pray, I would pay $10,000 for that, where I could hit a button and it would write my reviews and I would simply tweak them.
But then you'd not be working. Is that better?
Anything on this earth is better than writing. Although I'm such a loser, I can't stop writing. I changed my weekly deadline to a daily deadline to a sometimes four times a day deadline when I have idiot things to say on my Instagram.
You're posting every day on Instagram?
I post at least once a day, sometimes four, five. And I don't look at it. I do it very quickly in the morning in a state of obsession, need, desire.
Not precious.
No.
You're not precious.
No. I never, ever know what I'm going to post when I wake up. I scroll. I get a stupid idea. I write what I call a thumb essay. I write till my thumb gets tired, a little caption that long, and I move on. Then I seem to have expended enough terror and energy to get to work. And then when I get in bed, I look at it and I see what people say. And I've learned more, and so have you, I'll bet, more from my audience than I've learned anywhere in the world. Haven't you?
Mm. Yes, I would say, but let me ask you, do you have an urge to delete it if you don't like what people are saying? Do you think I should take this down?
Never, 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 never. It's for me, it's for the record, such as it is. I think that the record, while it lasts in idiot digital space, which will be like MySpace in 10 years, it will be technically inaccessible and 100% obsolete. But for the record, it's there and no one will ever look at it. It's all there and it'll be gone. But without that device, without that venue, I could not be what I am. It changed my life when I accidentally discovered Instagram and learned how to make it talk.
Mm. Are you excited, or how do you feel about Roberta retiring?
I'm very up. I'm very terrified of money. I'm not complaining. We both get a salary. I do not have a contract. I could be fired today. I always tell New York Magazine, God love them, you should fire me. I am not kidding. I love my work, but you should fire me because I don't know about art today. I can't stay up late enough with all you vampires, like having the discussions and learning the new dialects and deciding what is right and wrong. But I need the health insurance. And now that she doesn't have it, I have to get it. So, but I'm super excited and super terrified. And maybe somebody will hire her to do. Anybody listening to this, Roberta and I, if you pay us well and give us a great apartment, we will show up at your events and say pleasant things. And that's it. Wouldn't that be great?
That would be amazing. And a lot of people are going to consider that. You have a heart out, you know, in 5 minutes. And I just wanted to say that you and your wife are wildly easy to love. And I really appreciate you making the time. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Allie, for asking. And I really admire you taking up the mantle of a podcast. They're exciting. They're a fuck of a lot of work. They take a lot of energy. I don't know what they give back. I don't know how you can make money from it. But I really admire you and yours for trying, because I think that you
Thank
are laying
you so
important
much.
Foundations.
I really appreciate all the work you've done. And please tell your wife that I'm grateful she made the time for this, and congratulations on retiring.
I will. That's very kind of you to say. You're the first public announcement of it.
Oh, wow. Lucky me. Hey, Shabbat Shalom, Jerry.